in politics, you have to form a workable coalition that is big and broad enough to get elected. We tried incredibly hard with Jeremy and the Labour Party at that era, but we just could not, under that leadership, reconcile a big enough coalition to get elected.
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you, your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Servation's Strategic Communications Director, Carl Schoben. Servation is a market research company. They carry out polling to help organizations understand what people are thinking, and in the case of a general election, who they are planning to vote for. Before joining Servation, Carl had been Director of Communications for South London NHS Trust, Deputy Director of Engagement at NHS Improvement, Director of Strategy for former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, and a Communications Special Advisor for former Prime Minister Tony Blair. And Carl's just reminded me that back when I was a reporter for my local newspaper in Southeast London, the New Shopper, more than 20 years ago, he worked in my local hospital, Lewisham Hospital, which happens to be where my daughter was born as well. So, Carl, it's great to have you on the show during the general election fight. First, tell me, what is Servation and what does it do?
Servation is at heart a research company. So it researches public attitudes and it uses the products of its research to help design campaigns for clients, for political parties. We use data from polling to focus groups to face-to-face conversations with people to help campaigns make their issues more popular than they already are. So to make support for them broader, to find out what people are thinking, and then to help shape messaging and campaign tactics around that.
One of the clients at Higginson Strategy have worked for is Best for Britain. And I know that they worked for Servation and put a very valuable poll out recently, which looked at how the British public are going to vote. And I know that one of the things they're using is MRP polling. Now, just explain to us, what is MRP polling and how does it work?
So if you go back 20 years and beyond, voting patterns were relatively stable compared to what we have now. You tended to have shifts between the two main parties, with a party in the middle that took some of the votes of the two main parties at a pretty nationally uniform rate. Okay, so you had what is commonly known as a swing. So if you did a national poll, and let's suppose the Conservatives are 8 points ahead, you could pretty much apply that 8% in more or less the majority of constituencies in the country, and then you could calculate how many seats would be won and lost on the basis of an 8% change in the vote between the two main parties, with that party in the middle as well. So that's uniform national swing. In the last, I'd say, 15 years, and this is definitely speeded up, that uniform swing no longer applies. There are different voting patterns in different parts of the country. There are different issues that matter to people. There are different salience of issues that matter to people in a different way in different parts of the country. So you have, for example, a different type of electorate with different types of concerns. Not totally. Uniform swing is still important in, say, the northeast of the country than you would in, for example, somewhere like Surrey or London or Cornwall. So the polling industry has invented this MRP polling, which looks at how changes to national voting patterns will impact specifically in specific constituencies. So it's still reliant on national polling, but a much larger sample. So typically a national poll would be 1,000 or 2,000. An MRP needs to have 20,000 voters sampled and going up higher, generally higher than that. We use demographic models so that we know through a set of characteristics how those characteristics apply specifically to certain constituents. So we would know that one constituency has a certain population demographic. We know a certain constituency is going to have, let's say, immigration as a more salient issue than a different constituency. And by running about 20 different indicators through a large sample, we're able to look at how a vote that is nationally disproportionate would apply in constituencies. But it's still heavily reliant on a national polling figure. Okay, does that make sense?
There was a lot of information there, so I'm going to try and give a clear example of where MRP has been really useful. So MRP stands for multi-level regression and post-stratification polling. And a good example of where it would potentially be very effective is, imagine if you had a constituency that has a very large Muslim population who are very annoyed that the Labour Party have not been strong enough on Israel. Now, this issue might not get picked up by a national poll, but MRP, by understanding the particular constituents in that area, is much more accurate. The polling that we've found in the last few generations have used MRP and as a result have been much more likely to predict the actual outcome of the election.
So this is actually a good example of where MRP polling isn't that effective. So because MRP polling isn't going into each constituency with actual large enough sample sizes to pick up trends, it's making forecasts based on national polling and national sentiments. It's not very good at picking up specific issues, like, for example, an independent candidate that's doing well, or you know, someone like George Galloway. That is, we say to people all the time, in those constituencies where there are peculiar circumstances, MRP is not good at forecasting that. The issue of Israel and Palestine, though, is a national issue, and is picked up in sense of, for example, Muslim voters being perhaps more sceptical of voting Labour. So in areas where there are large Muslim populations, an MRP poll would take that into account. If you are just using polling to measure public attitudes, but it's not integrated as part of a wider communication strategy, I think it's generally telling you things that you instinctively probably already know. Okay, so polling, if it's used in that way, is useful for a media story. So if you're working in PR, you're representing a client and you want to raise the profile of your issue, a poll is very useful in that sense as a communication term, because it's an easy story for journalists. It's an easy story for the media to write up that, you know, 80% of people favour this. Okay. If it's used in that way, it doesn't really have an impact on change, and it doesn't really have an impact on influencing behavior and public opinion. It does have an impact on raising the profile, which is the absolutely crucial factor of communications, as you know. And I have used polling for many years doing just that in various different roles. But I think the most important thing you can do with polling from a communications perspective is use it to influence and to build up the sort of coalitions that are necessary in order to properly impact either changes of government policy, changes of behaviour, or change in the way an issue is viewed.
And how would a communications professional move from a simple poll where you get a headline that we're used to getting, such as 80% of people would choose to recycle more if it was made easier? How does that communications professional then make it more integrated?
Okay, that is a really good example, because you can always get people to say they agree or don't agree with something, or that they support something that's nice or not nice. But what you need to pick up from polling is how much people feel that and how important it is to them. So the salience of an issue is really important. I mean, what we do with research is we work at how much people feel things, how much people support things and how important they are, and then work out what sorts of things you could do or say to encourage people to actually act on what it is they say they support. Okay. And from that, if it requires a change of policy or a change of stance from politicians or councils, you would then use the polling in a way which makes those politicians understand that it's in their interest to act on this.
Going a little bit back in your career, going back to being a special advisor in Tony Blair's government when he was Prime Minister, just tell us about that and how that set you up for your communications career as it went on from there.
Okay, so I've got quite interesting insights on that period and sort of how it's changed the communications methods and strategies that are used to this day in some respects, some good, some are positive and some there are some negative. I was part of a sort of generation of young political advisors in the 1990s that were trying out new political communications techniques, some of them inherited from America, some of them inherited from the Clinton campaigns around the time. And that was a modern focus on message and message discipline. I mean, actually, these methods were used by the traditional right in politics forever in some ways. But what this was about was integrating some of those methods into the sort of left, centre-left and the more progressive side of politics. So you would have specific sort of departments and units in political parties whose sole aim it was to rebut negative attacks on your side. And it was to try and shape that day's agenda by making sure that it was your story that was, you know, it was just done with a degree of professionalism and a degree of system because it hadn't been done systematically before. So you had the grid, you had, you know, a day is effectively a timetable, a daily plan of what's going to happen each day. And you'd have people that would make sure that they would do whatever it took to make sure that formed the day's news agenda. And then Labour did that in opposition and then went into government and found that none of these methods were really being used in government at the time. So my role in Downing Street at the time was to help set up and establish that sort of political communications technique in government.
So, Cole, just tell me about that period, because it was a really interesting period of political communications. You came in and were working with Tony Blair's spin doctor, Alistair Campbell, and it sounds like you put a level of professionalism into communications that really wasn't there on the centre-left beforehand. Tell us a bit about what you did.
I think Alistair's view was that at the time, the left and the centre left had a massive disadvantage in media coverage, newspaper ownership. At the time, newspapers were far more important, you know, powerful than they are now, perhaps. And that presented a massive disadvantage to the left. But there were and are things that the left could do to try and compete on a more level playing field by making themselves more professional and how they communicated. And a lot of that was the kind of a professional and systematic ability to fight back, to respond to untrue or unfair accusations and attacks. But most importantly, to an extent, that has always happened in politics, but it's doing it in a professional and systematic way so that you can organise yourself, so that you can, so that you're not just shouting into thin air or into a forest that no one hears. You can do it in a way that actually gets heard and gets communicated in an effective way. And I think you know, Alistair can talk for himself, but at the time he had established this degree of professionalism from an opposition basis. And then when Labour at the time moved into government, there was a feeling that things were still relatively old-fashioned and backwards. There was no real coordination that was effective between different government departments. So you didn't have any sort of coordinated agenda on a day-to-day basis or a medium to longer term basis. So my role at the time was to work with Alistair as an advisor on establishing and setting up within government and within Downing Street some of these more professional systems for communicating in a more strategic way.
Great. And so and that's where the grid comes in, and anyone in political journalism understands what the grid is. It comes from Downing Street. It sets out what 10 Downing Street wants to be the news stories of the week, the main news stories. And they do it in a way so that different ministers and government departments aren't competing with each other for the airways. So, for instance, if the government has a great announcement that a whole load of extra spending is going to be spent on the NHS, they want to make sure people know about it. They want it to be on at the top of the news, on the front of the newspapers. They want to make sure that the Department for Transport isn't announcing some big train project on the same day that might be competing for that. So that's what the purpose of that grid was. It sounds really simple and like it's been in all the time, but it wasn't actually in when you were there, was it? Before that, you didn't have that system. Who brought that in?
Okay. I mean, I think there are different ways of looking at the grid. I think the grid is effectively a calendar. Okay, so sometimes when people see the grid, it's like this great fabled thing that, and when people see it, it just looks like a calendar with a list of events in it. And to an extent, that has always existed, depending on the efficiency of people running communication systems at the time. And I think that to an extent has always existed, but the importance of the grid as it was instituted, as you were saying, is the fact that it's taken seriously as a part of government strategy. So it becomes more than a calendar and a wish list of press releases, but it becomes what the Prime Minister of the day is actually saying they want to happen. And they are telling civil servants that it's their job to make that happen. So I think the grid, giving it a name, gives what is effectively a calendar a degree of strategic importance, so that everyone who's working within that field, within the communications field, within government, knows that they have to make it happen. They will be judged on whether it happens, and that they will have to produce a media strategy around a particular announcement that will get heard and noticed.
Great. What's been one of the most significant communications challenges you've faced in your career?
We were just chatting before we started recording about the fact that we both live locally, and that I remember you, John, as a reporter on the local newspaper, The New Shopper. When I went from a job as a special advisor, quite an important person, you know, within my field. And I took a job at my local hospital, at Lewisham Hospital, running their small communications department. And a lot of people wondered why I did that at the time. It seemed like quite a big change, big step. But actually, after years of working in national politics, very, very much focused on strategy and systems, I wanted to do something that was more real and day-to-day. And we can chat a bit about this probably a bit later. But I felt at the time that communications had become too, as a profession, as a field, it had become too focused on bigger strategy issues, too focused on narrative setting, agenda setting. And it risked becoming, as a profession, slightly disconnected from what it was actually trying to achieve. So you talk about a challenge. So Lewisham Hospital, and you know the hospital, it's got many challenges. It does some great things, and it does some poor things from time.
My daughter was born there as well as having various bones fixed there over the years. Yeah.
And I've got four kids that were all born there, like in the last 20 years.
Wow.
So it is a local institution that means a lot to a lot of people. It's a really, really important local institution that people are absolutely reliant on. And when I arrived there, there had been an undercover Panorama documentary, which was claiming with some truth that hospital was unhygienic, it wasn't being cleaned as well as it should, and there was an infection problem there at the hospital. MRSA at the time was the thing that was really worrying people locally. And there were demonstrations, and there was, constant scrutiny from local newspapers, from local politicians, councillors, and so forth. And it was a communications crisis for the hospital. And so I went to see the New Shopper's editor at the time. I think he's quite legendary and probably still the
Andy
editor.
Parks.
That's the guy. That's Andy the guy. Parks. And I went to see him and I said, look, we're getting a real hammering here. Is there any way you can help? And I was basically, as a slightly sort of desperate communications manager at local hospital, pleading with the local newspapers to give us a bit of a break and to write slightly fairer, slightly more balanced coverage. All right. This is an everyday communications problem that everyone that's worked in PR and communications, the sort of issues they faced. And he said, look, I would like people to have confidence in the local hospital. Okay. It's, people are massively interested, but I can't sort of do fluffy pieces because the hospital management wants me to. He said, let me spend a day there on my own, going around the hospital, with no one knowing who I am, where there are no patient confidentiality issues, to pretty much go around unimpeded. I won't tell you where I'm going to go, he said, because then you just plan and sort of make sure it's clean and all that sort of stuff. So I took this back to my bosses, and they were all absolutely horrified at the thought of this happening, because at the time, in PR and in management circles, in management consultancy circles, you had a culture where everything, information needed to be very tightly controlled. That was the culture. So, politicians.
Risk aversion.
You never let, in politics, you don't let a politician go anywhere without a press officer, that sort of thing. And, everything needs to be really carefully staged, managed. And this is one of the things that I think had started to come out of that period in Downing Street. I mean, didn't cause it, but it was reflected in the way communications was going. So with the professionalization of communications and PR management, you also began to get a distance and risk aversion and people not being able to say what they think and so forth. So your editor rightfully had picked up on this. He wasn't having any of this. And so he made his offer. The managers at Lewisham Hospital, the health authorities, you needed to run everything through the health authorities at the time and all that sort of thing. Even the Department of Health, you had to get sign off for this sort of thing from the Department of Health. Very, very heavily controlled. And no one wanted to do it, but I managed to convince them to do it. I said, look, we're in crisis here, and we need to get a really important local media on board, okay? And so it happened. He spent a day there, and he did a front page, and then inside about two or three more pages, just telling his story about a day in Lewisham Hospital. And it was really positive. Just like most people that go to hospital have positive experience by and large. Mm. He spent the day there and he wrote up a really brilliant and honest piece. Okay. Mm. And that actually, it started to reassure people. This newspaper was delivered to everyone's house in like three boroughs for free at the time. I don't think it's not anymore. And just that bit of open and honest and very risky communications managed to actually start to change the tide. in the way people perceived.
Well, I think that's
an important local institution.
I think that's a really good example, and a really good example of taking a risk and actually and that panning out. And it sounds like I was probably a reporter then at that time when you were doing that. I don't remember that particular story. And as you pointed out, I had done at least one story on Lewisham Hospital in my 3 years there.
Yeah.
What has been a big communications win that you've had? One of the ones that really sticks out in your long career?
So I think what I was describing earlier about being a good contributor to professionalising the sort of centre of government communications. I didn't do it alone, obviously, but I was part of something that I think has stuck. And the sort of strategic communications institutions are still there. They're dependent on the people that are running them and the government at the time and their particular political agenda on how successful they are, but they're still there. I think something I'm very proud of, so I mentioned earlier the role of research and polling organisations. It's not just to understand and know how people feel about certain attitudes, but it's how to work with the client or campaign to shape a campaign built around that. And for 2-3 years, I have worked very, very closely with a campaign to regulate internet online gambling more than it is now. So, you know, it's a terrible addiction and it destroys lives, and it's something that isn't talked about nationally or politically as much as it should be. So working with, it's actually Matt Zarb cousin who most people know from Twitter and very political circles.
Yes, but I know Matt personally. I know he's done a very good, been campaigning furiously on FOBTs, which is the fixed odd betting terminals that you used to get in betting shops.
Yeah. So the next phase of his campaign was to reduce access to advertising and promotion for children, to reduce the level of visible advertising on football shirts, and to reduce the amounts that people can bet in sort of one session, if you have to slow down the rate of online betting. Now, this is a really interesting campaign because we managed to, I mean, he comes from the left, kind of, you know, he worked for Jeremy Corbyn, but he managed to use, with the help of research, he managed to form a coalition, an alliance of the sort of more liberal-leaning public opinion who, you know, don't like big betting companies and they want more help for people with addictions and so forth, with that sort of Ian Duncan Smith traditional conservative view that, you know, gambling is a not a sin as such, but it's something that shouldn't be encouraged. And we managed to find a way of uniting very disparate groups from different political traditions into one campaign message, and one which managed to influence Labour MPs and a significant amount of Conservative MPs to get a majority to actually reform those gambling laws and to actually create an environment where there are more restrictions and more regulation than there was. Yeah. So that I think that's a real success. It's to find coalitions, bring them together, but to bring them together in a way where you're speaking with the same voice. It doesn't work if you're using two different arguments for two different groups of people.
I think that's such a useful and valuable way of lobbying, absolutely. And as we've all now got smartphones in our pockets, we've all got that potential temptation there, especially for people that are susceptible to gambling, to just at any moment go onto their phones and gamble away money that they don't have to gamble away. So that sounds really valuable that you got that cross-party support there for that change. What kind of trends do you see happening in the future for public relations and strategic communications?
I mean, obviously, things go in swings and roundabouts. So in the previous two general elections, for example, there was very limited outdoor advertising. I mean, this is just an example. It's like everything's digital and so forth. I think what you're seeing in this general election is some return, some small return, but I think it's worth looking at to some more traditional communications methods. So you're seeing more outdoor advertising. You're seeing more election debates than you would normally see. It's normally very limited, but you're on telly virtually every other night. You're seeing a bit of a return to more traditional campaigning, and I think that's really good. I think, you know, I mentioned it earlier, but one of the potential downsides of the massive professionalization of politics and communications is too much control over the central message, too many politicians appearing on television and not saying much, or not saying, you know, trying to avoid saying anything controversial. And then I think that contributed to a degree of apathy and cynicism that was obviously already there. So I think, you know, creeping back, and you can sort of see some of this. By no means, this isn't the only cause, but the relative success of politicians that are less PR professional. You could say Boris Johnson, you could say Nigel Farage, you could say Jeremy Corbyn. They're all politicians which have had peaks and troughs in the last few years. But I wonder if you wouldn't have seen those politicians succeeding 15 years ago in a way that they have come about and enjoyed at least some short-term success, because they represent more of a return to a more traditional grassroots style of politics and communications. And I can see that beginning to see some of that in the general election now, a bit of a return to some more old-fashioned PR.
Yeah. Well, we saw it in Clapton, didn't we, with Nigel Farage just grabbing hold of the speaker, passed to him by his head of communications, Gawain Towler, who had it on top of his head, and, you know, just the old-fashioned get on top of a soapbox type style. You spoke about Jeremy Corbyn there. You were his head of strategy for 2 years. And, you know, if we look back at his time, he had huge communications wins. I'm thinking back to kind of a whole crowd of people at Glastonbury. It's coming up to Glastonbury soon. Whole crowd of people at Glastonbury shouting out his name at Glastonbury. Never had that about any other politician.
But
then it didn't convert at the ballot box. Just tell me about the biggest wins and failures of that, because it's such a great example.
I mean, he had a relative win at the ballot box in 2017, in the 2017 election, you know, where he did far exceeded expectations. And I think that was about saying things that he believed in, and that came across. And many of those things were things that had been excluded from a sort of public debate. So, you know, things like public ownership is very popular, and, you know, people want to see the rich tax, you know. So what he was doing was, I think, at a certain point in time, reflecting the public's anger and cynicism towards politics and just what they perceived as unfairness in society. So I think that communications is part of the apathy that people feel. So the tight control and professionalization of political communications means that for a long period of time, you had politicians that were trained not to say things that could be controversial. Okay, which meant that these issues of inequality, unfairness, and so forth didn't get mentioned very much, or they were done in quite a controlled way. So I think the initial success of Jeremy Corbyn reflected people's, oh, here's a guy who's just telling it like it is. Okay. And if you ever worked with Jeremy, or you know Jeremy has no red light in his head when he's doing a political interview. He's not thinking, I shouldn't say that because that will get me into trouble. He is saying exactly what he thinks. Now, that is an incredibly dangerous thing for a political leader to do, but it also at various points worked for him and infused a lot of people. Where I think that sort of strategy started to fail was politics is incredibly complicated and you can't rely on being totally open and honest and saying what you think, because in politics you have to form a coalition, a workable coalition that is big and broad enough to get elected. And I think we tried incredibly hard with Jeremy and, you know, with the Labour Party at that era, in that period, but we just could not, under that leadership, reconcile a big enough coalition to get elected. I think it nearly succeeded in 2017, but the Brexit issue combined with Jeremy's slight unwillingness to do what it takes to form that strategic alliance just could not sustain itself with an issue as complicated as Brexit.
What advice would you give to your younger self?
I think that when you're younger, and I think this is less an issue with politics that doesn't really have that sort of corporate management culture that, say, working in the health service or any large sort of institution has. But I think communications has this great yearning to be heard at the top table. The first thing communications professionals say when they gather at meetings and conferences, oh, are you on the chief executive's board? Are you able to sit on a meeting? And that's enormously important. And I totally get why that is such a big issue. But when as a communications professional, you become immersed in that top table culture, there is a tendency to start thinking in that way as well, and to stop thinking about the users of a service or staff. And you start to see the communications mission to be purely in terms of reputation of the institution as seen from the top table. And I think I've certainly, you know, done some things and argued some things in the past on behalf of those organisations, which actually, years after, I actually think that was the wrong thing to do. I think, why didn't I listen to the people that were saying, we need this service here, or we need to do something differently? You know, and I just think that the advice to myself, or to a younger version of myself, or any communications professional, is to never disconnect from the people that are relying and using those services or voting for you, because you end up in sort of corporate management groupthink. And, you know, and you can see extreme examples of that with the post office scandal. I can sort of, in much different circumstances to that, I can see how a certain type of corporate culture becomes obsessed with protecting what it sees as its reputation and totally losing sight of what it is you're there to do.
Remember your customers, remember your users, remember your voters, remember who you're serving. That's the advice there from Carl Schoeben, Strategic Communications Director of Servation, speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose. If you'd like to know more about what Higginson Strategy does with purpose-led organisations, please go to higginsonstrategy.com. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.